Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A Palestinian suicide bomber killed three Israelis and wounded 18 more yesterday at a gas station at an Israeli settlement in the West Bank town of Ariel. In response, Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian farmers who were harvesting olives in a nearby village, and so it goes. The settlement issue is back on the front burner and heating up in the Israeli government. Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer and his Labor Party are threatening to vote against Prime Minister Sharon's 2003 budget unless money slated for settlements is redirected to social programs. If that happens, Sharon is threatening to kick Labor Party ministers out of his cabinet in a move that could force early elections. In this hour, Israel's settlement policy, vital security blanket or blockade to peace. We begin with the latest news from Israel. James Bennett is Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. I asked about Israel's latest political crisis and how the settlements factored in.
There's a big fight brewing within Ariel Sharon, Israel's prime minister's coalition government, between the Labor Party, which is the largest member of the coalition, and the right-wing Likud party of Mr. Sharon. Labor is saying that money that's earmarked now for the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip should go instead to pay for other social needs.
This is something like $150 million, roughly.
It's a little less than that. It's not a huge percentage of the budget, and in some ways it's a symbolic fight. But they're saying that the elderly, the poor, other needy groups are being asked to shoulder the burden of closing the budget deficit, then the settlers are being exempted from that kind of sacrifice.
How significant amount of money is that in terms of the settlers? Is it everything the government gives to them, or is it just a fraction of its support for settlers?
No, it's just a fraction. And as I say, this is a largely symbolic fight, which is much intended to transmit a populist message to the population at large about the budget as it is to deliver a specific message to the Labor Party voters, who tend to be more left-wing than the public at large, about settlers.
So what's the political fight behind the settlement issue here?
Well, there's a complicated dynamic at work here, as is almost always the case in Israeli politics. There are internal Labor Party elections coming up in November. The Labor Party leader is the defense minister, this guy Benjamin Ben-Eliezer. Mm-hmm. He's now running behind in those elections. So he needs an issue that appeals to his party faithful. Settlements is an issue that does exactly that. So by standing up now and opposing settlement expansion and opposing this additional amount of money going to the settlements, he's able to present himself as fighting for an issue his voters most care about. Now, we should be careful to note that, of course, Mr. Ben-Eliezer says this is all about principle and not at all about politics.
Duly noted. But he's looking for support as he goes into his own struggle for power, but it may impinge on Ariel Sharon's position in power.
That's exactly right. Labor is a very important part of this very broad coalition that Ariel Sharon has had for 19 months now. Once Labor goes, Ariel Sharon is going to have to assemble a new government. It's likely to move substantially to the right from where it is now, and he's going to have to try to govern without a majority, which is a very tricky thing to pull off.
Sharon is saying that if that doesn't work, he's fully prepared to go to elections and to contest with Labor's candidate.
Exactly. And within his own party, he's quite strong right now, according to polling here, and is probably in a decent position to do that, particularly if there's a war in Iraq. He can argue that at a time like this, Israel really needs continuity in its leadership. The nation should rally around him, etc.
James Bennett, pull back from this immediate political fight for a moment to look at settlements with us. How do the settlements figure more broadly into Israel's politics, into Israel's view of the conflict with the Palestinians and their place in the world?
The settlements are in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which is the territory that Israel occupied during the 1967 war. And since then, fairly systematically, Israeli government after government has settled Israelis in those territories. There are about 200,000, a little more than that, Israelis now living in the West Bank and Gaza among about 3 million Palestinians. The Palestinians consider the settlements one of the greatest provocations. Evidence, they say, that Israel never plans to part with that territory and permit them to have their own state there.
Have you seen polls on how Israelis themselves look at the settlements these days?
In general, the vast majority of the Israeli public is not particularly supportive of the settlements. There's a new poll out now that shows that some more than 70% of Israelis would happily part with the settlements as part of an overall peace agreement with the Palestinians. That is, a final solution to this conflict that they could feel confident in. The thing is that now, without that kind of an agreement in sight, Israelis are a little more sympathetic to the settlers on a day-by-day basis, because they feel like all Israelis are vulnerable to this kind of violence, and therefore it's no time to really be deserting, abandoning these settlers. The hardcore of settler support is about 1 in 5 Israelis, which is not a negligible percentage of the population.
And what does it mean to be a hardcore supporter of the settlements?
It means you don't want to dismantle any settlements under any circumstance.
Does that mean that you support effectively the annexation of the West Bank and Gaza?
Essentially, that's what it boils down to.
The settlements have been in the news in a couple of other ways in the last week. One was we saw the Israeli military actually almost fighting hand-to-hand with settlers who were in a settlement that was not officially designated. Then we hear over the weekend of settlers firing on Palestinians who were harvesting olives, and I think I saw one American peace activist actually killed in those clashes. What's going on with these two bits of news?
There's an interesting generational divide among settlers. Young settlers who are trying to be more radical than their parents have established a lot of these outposts on top of hilltops out there, often with the support of the settler movement. But they've proved more radical than their parents, and in some cases, the established settlers don't like to see this violence with the army, even don't like to see the attacks on Palestinians, partly because they recognize it's terrible publicity for them, but partly because they say it's against their values. But you have this very, very hardcore of radical young settlers out there right now. And the army, under this defense minister, has recently started dismantling some of these settlements that Israel considers illegal. But each time they pull one down, the people return and put it right back up again.
And the clashes with Palestinians among the olive trees, why?
This is an annual thing. Sadly, the olive tree, which is a symbol of peace all over the world, is in fact a source of conflict here. The olive harvest brings the Palestinians out into the orchards. In some places, it brings them close to settlement fences, or settlers simply want to chase the Palestinians back because they're trying to accumulate more territory. So you have settlers coming out and, in some cases, harassing, attacking, even beating some of these Palestinian farmers. By the way, I should add, some settlers claim that the Palestinians, in harvesting their trees, are also scouting ways to attack the settlement.
James, is there any more potent symbol among Israel politicians and between Israelis and Palestinians than the settlements? Is this the most potent political symbol in this conflict today?
The Palestinians think of it that way, certainly, but the Israelis don't. The Palestinians regard settlements as this ongoing provocation, mm-hmm. as eating up land that belonged to their parents, their grandparents, and now depriving them even of their own olives. But to Israelis, there's more ambivalence about the settler movement, because even Israelis who live in places like Haifa and Tel Aviv, some of them still see settlers as part of the original pioneering movement of the State of Israel. That is, the early Zionist Jews who came and settled here in the late 19th century and established outposts that eventually produced the State of Israel to begin with.
James Bennett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
James Bennett is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. We're diving in tonight deep into the rough waters of Israel's settlement policy in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In a recent essay in the New York Times, Thomas Friedman wrote, "The settlement policy Israel has been pursuing is going to lead to the demise of the Jewish state." Do you agree? Do settlements ensure Israel's security or ultimately threaten it? Are settlements part of Israel's manifest destiny? Are they critical leverage for peace or just in its way? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight are two heavy hitters on each side of this debate from Larchmont, New York. Mark Rosenblum is professor of history at Queens College and a longtime student of the Israeli settlements. Good evening and welcome, Professor Rosenblum.
Thank you.
And from New York City, Morton Zuckerman, publisher of the New York Daily News and editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report, is with us tonight. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Zuckerman.
Good evening to you.
Thanks for joining us. Mark Rosenblum, let me turn to you first, if I may. If you'd be good enough to give us the capsule history of the settlements. There's a lot we want to talk about tonight. We're getting everything on the table. We've been talking about U.S. pressure on Palestinians to clean up their act. There's a lot of talk about Iraq cleaning up its act. We're looking at the settlements and what should not be done there. But give us the history first.
Well, very briefly, as James mentioned from Jerusalem, where we are today in the settlement process is, if you count all of the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, mm-hmm. you have on the vicinity of a little more than what he suggested, about 210,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank and Gaza.
All right.
And they constitute about 146 Israeli settlements. And they, on the other hand, are surrounded and are in the midst of a population of about 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Mm-hmm. The settlement process began very modestly after the 1967 war when Israel defended itself against the Arab invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And they then held out the prospect, the Labor Party at that time, of holding out territories as a bargaining chip and waited for the eternal phone call from the Arab states to make peace.
When you want peace, call us and you can have the territory back.
That's right. Well, not all of the territory, mm-hmm. because they did annex East Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
which was under Jordanian control, mm-hmm. and a significant swath of what was the West Bank as well. So they actually expanded and extended the Israeli capital of Jerusalem, so it not only included the East Jerusalem, Jordanian half, but also part of the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And it gradually expanded settlements. The dramatic increase took place in the second administration of Menachem Begin. And there you had a profound expansion, not simply in terms of what the Labor Party historically identified as insecurity corridors that mm-hmm. would be perceived as part of a slightly enlarged, secure state of Israel, mm-hmm. but they started to intrude on and adjacent to the major demographic centers of the West Bank.
And what was the rationale then and now, I guess?
Well, there's always multiple senses of rationale mm-hmm. for this, and it depends which Israeli constituency you talk about. For part of the Israelis, and what was, I think, a dynamic part of this after the 67 war, a group of Israelis that were messianic, religious nationalists, took their lightning victory in the 67 war as a divine statement that God himself was now acting to help honor the covenant of the Jewish people and Abraham for all of the entirety of the West Bank, referred to mm-hmm. in biblical and historical terms as Judea and Samaria. This was a religious motivation, but most Israelis, including the Labor Party, were moved primarily by fundamental security concerns. Important to note that up until 67, the Palestinians, including the PLO that had been taken over by Fatah and Arafat, had engaged in a war that most everyone, I think, credibly could say was a war of politicide to destroy the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the message they seemed to be using, armed struggle, seemed to smell of genocide. So, to be honest here, an important mm-hmm. background, the Palestinians seemed to want the land between the river and the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Settlements was not an issue for them. The very existence of the State of Israel was.
Rosenblum, stand by. I want to bring Mort Zuckerman in. Mort Zuckerman, how do you see the settlements at this point? In brief, we'll come back to it. But do you see them as a critical bargaining chip for an ultimate peace, a way station on the way to a two-state solution? How do you see them?
Well, let me just point out that at Camp David in the year 2000, the issue of settlements was one that was quite reasonably and constructively resolved. It was not the stumbling block to whatever was going to happen, and it was hardly, as you suggested, I may add, the most potent symbol of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The most potent symbol today surely is the terrorism against innocent civilians.
Well, it may be a charred bus today from an Israeli vantage point. We understand that.
Well, I'm glad that you do understand. It would be nice if you mentioned it. So let me just finish what I have to say here. I don't think, and I think most people recognize, even in 1978 at the first Camp David agreement where the Israelis agreed to freeze all the settlements, were the Palestinians to join in a dialogue with them then,
mm-hmm.
they absolutely refused. So this has been ongoing, not just even prior to 1967 when, as Mark points out, this effort at terrorism against Israel began, that it clearly was based on the deliberate desire to end the state of Israel. And this has been the fear of a lot of Israelis and a lot of the settlements, which have gone through both Menachem Begin's government, Yitzhak Rabin's government, Shimon Peres' government, Ehud Barak's government.
Mort Zuckerman, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Fully understood and acknowledged. What do you think? Do the settlements ensure Israel's security or ultimately threaten it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza and asking, are they necessary for Israel's survival? Or have they become, might they become a threat to Israel's existence? My guests tonight are Mark Rosenblum, he's professor of history at Queens College, and Morton Zuckerman, publisher of the New York Daily News and editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Tom Friedman writes recently in the New York Times that Israel's settlement policy is going to lead to the demise of the Jewish state. Do you agree, or is this a critical bulwark? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Mort Zuckerman, I'm sorry we had to interrupt there. And granted, it is a very rough neighborhood. We're going to have Jeffrey Goldberg on tomorrow night talking about the huge buildup of Hezbollah just to the north in Lebanon, and the threat is clearly there. At the same time, Tom Friedman's argument caught our attention. He's saying, look, demographics, if you continue to settle in this way and with these kind of incentives, ultimately you're going to have a de facto or de jure annexation of these territories. It's going to be seen as one great nation where Palestinians far outnumber Israelis. And at that point, you've got a real problem on your hands.
To be honest with you, I think that is a hypothetical that is simply is irrelevant to what is ultimately going to be the outcome. I think the vast bulk of the Israelis, and I hope the vast bulk of the Palestinians, understand there is going to have to be a two-state solution, the demographics being only one part of that issue.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis do not want to run the lives of 2.5 to 3 million Palestinians. And I might add, before this last episode or period of violence began, 99% roughly of the Palestinians were under Palestinian rule in the West Bank, mm-hmm. not under Israeli rule. So I think this is the general direction. And I don't believe that the settlements are going to be the blocking factor in any ultimate agreement, as they weren't in the year 2000. They certainly will be a factor in the negotiations. And the entire area of the built settlement take up about 1.5% of the West Bank. So I don't think that is going to be the issue. There will be a number of settlements, roughly 80% or slightly more of the so-called settlements are really close into the major urban areas in Israel. And there will be some kind of land swap or some kind of compromise on the land so that those settlements remain with Israel and some additional security belt around it. And the rest of the land will, with a partner that the Israelis feel they can rely upon, ultimately become undoubtedly a part of some kind of Palestinian state. The real problem is not the fact that there are settlements going on. The real problem is the fact that the terrorism that has ensued since, after all, the dialogue was going on at Camp David, when you had the most forthcoming Israeli offers ever put on the table, and the terrorism began in that context. The real problem is that there is no confidence on the part of the Israelis, and in fact, a lack of confidence supported by the American administration, that the Israelis have a partner with whom they can negotiate peace. The whole idea of the reform on the Palestinian side that has been talked about by President Bush and indeed by a number of Europeans as well as the Israelis is to see if you could develop through some different kind of organization of the government of that part of the community, the Palestinian community, a partner with whom you could have a reliable peace agreement. Clearly, that has not happened. After all, if the Palestinians had stopped the incitement that they began after 1993, stopped the violence that began after 1993, there would have been a completed agreement at this point, and they would have had a country on 97% of the West Bank with a Palestinian flag that would have, in a sense, been devoted to the improvement of the lives of the Palestinian. Instead, the Palestinian Authority has devoted itself to the destruction of Israel. That's been the fundamental problem
that has caused the
failure of the negotiations to date.
And here we come to this issue of confidence. Mark Rosenblum, give us your interpretation. There is clearly a confidence problem on both sides of the table here. How do you read this? I mean, the Israelis fear that Palestinians won't be satisfied, some Israelis fear, unless Israel's gone. On the other hand, Palestinians fear that there are Israelis who are bound and determined to have this West Bank land.
Mort is clearly correct in emphasizing Palestinian culpability and responsibility in terms of violence and terrorism and shattering the Israeli belief about partner and about peace. But what I think he's wrong at, and here's why I agree with Tom Friedman, is that the settlements still represent what I characterize as an SOS. It is, as James said, symbolism over substance. In many respects, it's absolutely critical.
What do you mean by that?
Let me make five very brief points about what I characterize as an Israeli SOS on the settlements issue, and speaks to what Tom Friedman, I think, is suggesting in his op-ed, that the settlements, independent of Palestinian behavior and culpability and violence and terrorism, undermines Israeli security and stands in the way of empowering the very reformed tendency that Mort speaks to and that all Israelis and all supporters of peace should want to see happen.
Give us your points.
Number one, I think that the settlements themselves, all 146 of them in the West Bank and Gaza, increase Israel's security borders. That is the parameter that the IDF must defend by tenfold. If you can contrast the 67 borders with where the settlements are in the West Bank and Gaza, it makes the job of the Israeli Defense Forces and the security establishment in Israel near impossible.
It was supposed to make it easier. It was supposed to give Israel strategic depth.
Let me go through them quickly. This is one of, I think, the security burdens. It's a liability, not an asset in terms of settlement.
Okay, next.
Secondly, it makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for Sharon to build a fortified line that's more defensible. The reason the often ballyhooed talk of a security fence and a wall that would be built to deal with the murderously porous borders that Israel now has that renders Israel so subject to terrorist attacks, the prime minister cannot build that because the settlements, many of them are clearly on the wrong side of this parameter, this would-be fortified fence.
But they are building it right now.
Well, it's very slow, and the fence is being built to try and incorporate the settlements that are willy-nilly scattered throughout the West Bank and make a coherent building of a security parameter impossible. That's my point. It's openly acknowledged by security people in Israel.
And you got a couple more points there.
Yeah. The third point, it refers to Mort and the building of a moderate reformist tendency on the Palestinian side. And it goes back to his point about what happened at Camp David, where settlements was ostensibly, he argues, not an issue at all. I'd argue with the settlements communicated to many Palestinians, not to justify their response in terrorism, but it revealed a contradiction between a generous offer, which I think was an accurate way of thinking about what Barak did offer at Camp David, but that was belied by the facts on the ground. Why were the Israelis presenting a map that started out at 88% that got up, as Mort suggested, at the end of the process in Tab of 2001 at 97%, while the Israelis are continuing to double the number of Jewish settlements in the West Bank? There were 110,000 Jewish settlers when that glorious handshake on the south lawn of the White House took place in September of 1993. It doubled by the year 2000.
So, you see a contradiction there.
There was a disconnect and a contradiction, and it's weakened, in my opinion, and the illegal settlements that we have not talked about, that number 106 since 1996, 60 since, by illegal, I mean settlements that have not been approved.
And your last point or two, Mark Rosenblum?
Well,
sorry, Mark, we'll be right to you. Let me just get the last ones out here. Mark?
And I think the last and critical point is it also has prevented the Israelis from coming up under Sharon with a peace initiative, because how are they going to accommodate? As Sharon has said, he treats one isolated settlement in Gaza, Netzarim, as if it is the equivalent of Tel Aviv. And this kind of pronouncement, and I think the prime minister has contributed to a sense of hopelessness and absence of a peace process.
Mort Zuckerman, your reply.
Well, look, you know, it's hard really to figure out where to start here. All I can say is that the Palestinians at Camp David accepted the kind of divisions that involved the retention by Israel of those critical settlements that comprise the areas where roughly 80% of the settlers live. And this was not the issue that is described by Mark. Now, you could argue that almost anything doesn't contribute to the positive mood, but I would suggest to you, since I was in Israel at that time and again in 1996, when they had the most liberal and forthcoming Israeli prime ministers, Peres in 1996 and Barak in the year 2000, that's when the Palestinians launched these terrible campaigns of terrorism that, in a sense, brought about both Netanyahu and Sharon to power, because the issue of Israeli security in the face of what were very, very constructive Israeli offers to the Palestinians became the issue of security, and the real motives of the Palestinian became the issue.
Mort Zuckerman, what about this issue of contradiction, of facts on the ground?
The facts on the ground, whatever they were, there are facts on the ground on both sides. The violence is a fact on the ground. The expansion on the part of the Israelis of the whatchamacallit, the settlements, was in fact in part a deliberate attempt to try and put pressure on the Palestinians to sit down and negotiate. The demographics on the Palestinian side were pressure against the Israelis. There were all kinds of countervailing forces that were there. But the central issue here that really has prevented an agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, clearly, it seems to be by almost every American standard at least, is the violence that was launched in the context of the most forthcoming offers from an Israeli prime minister. And that, it seems to me, is something that is inescapable. And the attempt to blame the failure to proceed now on the settlements, in my judgment, is absolutely wrongheaded and does not really conform to what really happened. Sure, Sharon is sitting there and saying, I'm not going to deal with the settlements now for a good reason. It would involve a huge political cost on his part without any possibility of a gain, because he doesn't have a partner with whom he can reliably negotiate. And all the Israelis virtually across both sides of the political spectrum, because the peace camp in Israel has collapsed as a result of the violence.
We hear you, Mort Zuckerman. Mort Zuckerman, Mark Rosenblum, a lot of callers want to join us. Let's invite them in. Callers, do the settlements ensure Israel's security or ultimately threaten it? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jerry's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey. Very interesting conversation. I want to point out one thing, and then I have a question. And that is that let's not forget that there were Jews living in the West Bank prior even to the 1948, and that's often forgotten, this discussion. It's not like only after 1967 Jews moved into the West Bank. I mean, the settlement of Kfar Etzion was somewhere Jews went back to, and of course there was Jewish population in Hebron that was essentially kicked out. And
What does that say to you, Jerry? What should we take from that?
Well, my question is, you know, even in that context, I wonder what your two guests think of, you know, even though Sharon's hands may be tied right now, he's the only person in the game who was able to dismantle settlements that the Jews created, and that was in the Sinai. And,
right.
And he was
sort of Nixon to China dynamic.
So, I mean, he is in the driver's seat right now. Do you think he's the only one that can really do it now, if anybody's going to do it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Jerry. Mark Rosenblum, how about it? Ariel Sharon has been intimately associated with settlement, yet maybe there could be a Nixon to China dynamic. Can you imagine it?
Well, he's referring to the historic role that Sharon played during the first Camp David, where the sticking question at the end of the day is what would happen with the Jewish settlements in the Sinai. And Begin called from Washington and spoke to Sharon and wanted to know if Sharon could get this through the Knesset, that Begin was not going to sign anything away on the settlements, and the Knesset needed to deal with this. And Sharon took it upon himself and managed to gain support within Likud and within the Knesset for the evacuation of every last settlement in the Sinai. And some people suggest this is a foreshadowing of a more statesmanlike, pragmatic prime minister.
Well, may I add something to that?
I want to add, but I think the key point is this is different than his entire biography in the West Bank. I don't think it was simply a ruse when prime minister, when he was a foreign minister, I believe in December of 98, talked about everyone should take action, should run, grab more hills, expand the area. Whatever is seized will be ours.
You're saying Ariel Sharon said this.
This is Sharon. I think that Sharon's commitment to West Bank and Gaza and uprooting the settlements in the West Bank is less likely there for reasons having to do with strong visions of ideological predisposition and also, I think, his view of security. And I disagree with Mort in terms of, while no one has an X-ray into Sharon's mind, and some people argue when he's prime minister the second time round, if he's so fortunate, he will show the true colors that Mort outlined in terms of going back to a real territorial compromise. I frankly do not see it in the biography of the man. He's had opportunities in his own prime minister now to exploit the military success he's had.
Mark Rosenblum, we've got it. The second time around, maybe coming up soon. Mort Zuckerman, come in here, please.
Yes. He went, at first place, he was in the military at the time of Camp David, and he led the military forces that forcibly removed the settlers from Sinai. That was, so when it came to the, when the rubber hit the road at that point, he was there. He was, again, a key player in the agreement with Jordan in terms of working out the settlement of water distributions with Jordan in order to make the agreement with Jordan possible. My only point here is that when he has been in a situation at whatever level he has been in where there has been a serious partner for peace, he has understood that compromises will have to be made.
So if the White House gets back up on the high road of a fast-track solution, sure, please.
What he calls painful compromises, even as he is the prime minister. Now, when you are sitting in a situation and you are a politician and you want to retain your office, there's no doubt but that you're not going to make painful compromises that will cost you a great deal unless there's some reward or benefit for the country and for yourself politically. Not only he doesn't see it, but most of the country doesn't see the possibility of dealing with Arafat, who violated every agreement he's ever signed with the Israelis. So, and that's the reason why there is now on the American side with the policy of President Bush, and indeed in many other countries, including the Israelis, a sense that in order to advance the peace process, you're going to have to find some different kind of partner other than Arafat on the other side. And at that point, he has clearly indicated when he says painful compromises, he is clearly talking about a territorial compromise, which is exactly what he has said both publicly and privately many times.
Let's get one more call before the break. John's on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. My only comment and question is I think you make and dismantle settlements through acts of war. And if these people are interested in peace, they need to turn the conversation to societies that allow for ethnic diversity. So
people, do you mean Palestinians, Israelis, both?
Both sides. I mean, I think the long-term solution is these settlements are going to stay. There's going to be a Palestinian state that is a democracy and allows for Israelis to live there. And there's going to be an Israeli state that allows for Palestinians to live there.
John, we've got that point. I want to put it to Mort Zuckerman. Mort, the White House has talked about a two-state solution. They've talked about, as soon as they can get the agenda cleared here, pushing on that quickly, trying to make progress toward it. Do you see Ariel Sharon as a leader who would be a good partner for making that happen?
Yes, I do, but there are certain conditions that the White House has established.
Lots.
And the most critical one is the cessation of terrorism and violence and the incitement to terrorism and violence before political negotiations can take place. And I think that is the key that is going to unlock this particular Pandora's box. I mean, I'm not all that optimistic about it, but I think, frankly, that the record shows that the Israelis have been quite forthcoming and have been prepared to do it. And when they were sitting across the table from, unfortunately, a leadership headed up by Ariel Sharon, I happen to have been directly involved in Camp David. The most galling thing about Camp David in the year 2002 is Arafat never engaged in the negotiations. He never made a counterproposal. Instead, they kicked off a campaign of violence and terrorism, which was intended by Arafat's own statement, where he said, within 6 months, we will break the Israeli will. In fact, whatever it was that he wanted to accomplish beyond what he could get for some extraordinary deal. I will just point out to you that Arafat was asked by Wahid, the president of Indonesia, why did you accept the deal at Camp David? He said, we have 150 years, we'll drive them into the sea. If that's the partner you have in a negotiation, you're not going to make any major concessions up front.
It's a tough conversation. Mort Zuckerman, stand by. We've got a break coming up. Listeners, do the settlements ensure Israel's security or ultimately threaten it? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. My guests are Mark Rosenblum. He's professor of history at Queens College. And Morton Zuckerman, publisher of the New York Daily News and editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report. You are welcome to join us as well. Are the settlements vital to Israel's security? And what does the Israeli government's support of increasing settlements say about its seriousness about a two-state solution? Are the settlements necessary leverage to bring Palestinians finally one day to the peace table, or are they an impediment to peace? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Ellen's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I spent the 80s on and off reporting from the region for various U.S. publications, mm-hmm. and I know a fair amount about both the settler movement and the settlements. I have my first point is all the settlements are illegal. They are illegal under the Fourth Geneva Conventions of 1949, which forbid an occupying power to settle its citizens on occupied soil. They are illegal under the United Nations Security Council Resolution number 446 of the 22nd of March, 1979, which pointed out that the Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, including the Golan Heights, quote, have no legal validity and constitute a serious obstruction to achieving a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace in the Middle East.
Ellen, take us through that to what you mean by that. We're in a region where there's so much that's illegal. How do you see it?
What I mean by that?
Yes.
There is a rule of international law. Of course, it's being flouted roundly by many nations, including perhaps our own, as President Bush blithely says that he's going to march unilaterally into war on Iraq.
Are you suggesting international law should be imposed in Israel and the West Bank? Sorry?
Absolutely, yes. Imposed. It is incumbent on all nations to abide by the rule of law. We have laws in the United States. They forbid, you're not supposed to steal. You're not supposed to murder. If you commit a crime under law, you are brought before a court and you are called to justice.
Let's put it to Mort Zuckerman. So stand by, Ellen. We'll come back to you, Mort Zuckerman. Ellen says settlements are illegal. And legality ought to be imposed by the international community.
Well, everybody has their own version of what the facts are and what the law is, and let me just make a couple.
Is it really debatable?
May I just at least finish my answer before you jump in and tell me I'm wrong?
Oh, Mort, I jump all over.
We have Resolution 242 and 338, which basically describe that there will be, in effect, a territorial compromise in there to bring about peace and security and secure and recognized boundaries. And until that happens, virtually everything is legal, not illegal. What happens at the UN, as we all know, where there's an automatic majority against Israel, is not something that indicates whether something is legal or illegal, but whether something is politically favorable to a certain group of countries led by the Arab world or not. So I think this is a wholly different kind of an issue here, and I appreciate the caller's passion and fervor about it, but it does seem to me that there is and has been a demonstrated willingness on the part of the Israelis, who are, after all, a democracy which inherently likes peace, to try and bring about a peaceful resolution of the differences between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And the response that they have had, particularly since 1993, has been a campaign of incitement that has produced a culture of hatred and violence that we are now living with in that region that has blocked it. So, I mean, I might tell you that both the Clinton administration believes that, or the ex-members of the Clinton, and the Bush administration believes that. So, I mean, everybody has their own views about this thing, but what the UN does or doesn't do vis-a-vis the Middle East is surely something that has to be looked at, to put it mildly, in the most political of all contexts, since there is an automatic majority that condemns Israel for everything, no matter what it does, and never has once condemned Palestinian terrorism, just to give you an example of the fairness with which the UN approaches these issues.
Ellen, are you still there?
It's not a matter of subjective opinion, Mr. Zuckerman. It is not my own views. It is not your own views. It is not that the Palestinians feel that this is an obstacle to peace. There should be a rule of international law. I can make a great many other points. For example, just recently, I had a communique via the Internet. There's also a Haaretz article about it, about the vigilante attacks of settlers on Americans in an international observer corps trying to protect Palestinian farmers harvesting their crops. This happened to be at a village from which almost all of the inhabitants have been forced to flee by settler vigilantism. In 1979, I wrote a very long essay for the Village Voice, and never mind me, consider Robert I. Friedman's book, Zealots for Zion, which describes the continuous depredations and vigilantism of the settlers against the surrounding Palestinian population almost from day one.
Ellen, I think we've got your perspective, and we've got the legal point as well. Mort Zuckerman?
Let me just make a point in that regard, okay? Prior to the violence that was launched in September of the year 2000, there were 125,000 Palestinians working in Israel. The per capita income in the West Bank was the highest in the Arab world. The fact is that 99% or 98% of the Palestinians were under Palestinian rule. There is undoubtedly cases of vigilantism, I would agree, but the vast bulk of them are in response to a continued campaign of harassment, assassination, murder, and violence, including the violence that seeks to maximize the number of civilian casualties on the Israeli side. I think it has been clear that on both sides of the aisle, from Menachem Begin on one side to Ehud Barak on the other, that there has been a commitment on the part of the Israelis to try and bring about a peaceful resolution of these issues. And with all due respect, I appreciate your points. I do think that the issue is not the settlement. The issue has been the violence and the fact that the Israelis have come to believe that the violence reflects a desire on the part of the Palestinians who started this before there was a single Jew on the West Bank. Never mind before there was a single Jew in East Jerusalem.
Ellen, thank you for your call. Mark Rosenblum, I want to bring you in. Mort Zuckerman points straight to the continuing terrorism and says, how can you think of focusing on the settlements when this terrorism goes on? There's not a real partner for peace here. Is that your perspective?
No, I think that the central point that Mort makes, I'll say for a second time, is correct, that Palestinian violence and terrorism and incitement is a primary reason why there's so much murder and mayhem, and people have lost for the moment a sense of bearings about how to get to peace. But that does not, in my opinion, and this is the central issue that you began the program with in the quotation of Tom Friedman, this does not obviate the Israeli government from asking the question what it can do vis-a-vis settlements and in terms of a political initiative from a point of view of strength that would help empower and strengthen the democratic dove forces that Mort and others of us so desperately want to win and replace Arafat with a more responsible leadership.
We've just got 40 seconds. What could they do?
Well, I think very clearly one of the things they can do is seriously attack the illegal settlements issue, which I think Bennett at the outset correctly said was largely Ben Eliezer's opportunistic political attempt to shore up his. But there needs to be a more sustained commitment on Sharon's part to removing the 60 illegal settlements built under his efforts. He ought to also be able to outline a political initiative that strengthens the moderates to, as Mort suggests, wait for that happy day when the Palestinians replace Arafat is not going to be, in my opinion, simply a Palestinian issue. There are things that Israeli government can do of a settlement freeze nature of all of the settlements, remove the illegal settlements.
Mark Rosenblum, with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Mark Rosenblum is professor of history at Queens College. And Mort Zuckerman, thank you for being with us tonight.
Mort Zuckerman, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Mort Zuckerman is publisher of the New York Daily News. In a moment, a look at tightening Senate race in Georgia. This is On Point. Georgia's junior senator Zell Miller is getting a lot of attention in the suddenly tight race for the Senate in the Peach State, and Miller isn't up for re-election this year. Just as candidates across the nation are trying to cash in on George W. Bush's popularity by pointing to their support of the president, the two candidates in Georgia's Senate race are doing their best to align themselves with the wildly popular Miller. In an unruly debate Sunday night, incumbent Democrat Senator Max Cleland and his Republican challenger, Representative Saxby Chambliss, tussled over issues ranging from who is more like Zell Miller to who is going to protect Social Security for seniors. The high tension at the debate is indicative of how close the race has become, as Senator Cleland's early lead has nearly evaporated. Here are excerpts from Sunday night's debate, beginning with a question for Republican Representative Saxby Chambliss.
I'd like to ask about the role of Zell Miller. Senator Cleland, you have Zell Miller's endorsement. He is in commercials for you. And yet there is no doubt that your voting record in the United States Senate is considerably different from the way Zell Miller has voted on many major issues. And if I could pose the second question while I'm doing this, Mr. Chambliss, you held up Zell Miller as a model for understanding the issues and dealing with things the way you'd like things dealt with. But part of that is he's supporting your opponent. It's a strange situation. Why don't we start with you on that?
Okay, well, you know, it's a question of leadership, Bill. Here we have the junior senator from Georgia providing strong leadership in the United States Senate when the senior senator is not. And Zell Miller votes the way a majority of Georgians think. Now, they're out there now saying, well, Mr. Cleland votes with him 4 out of 5 times. The problem is those 4 times he votes with him are to open the session, to close the session, to approve the journal, and to vote to go home. It's that fifth vote. It's the fifth vote on making tax cuts permanent. It's the fifth vote on gutting the tax bill of President Bush. It's the fifth vote on allowing the creation of the president's and Zell Miller's Department of Homeland Security.
But do you believe that Zell Miller's endorsement of Max Cleland is disingenuous?
No. Zell Miller is a Democrat, and I fully expected him to endorse him. You know, we've been fortunate to get a number of Democrats to endorse us, and I'm very proud of that fact. I'm very humbled by it. But I understand Senator Miller is a colleague in the United States Senate on the Democratic side, and it's only natural that he endorse him.
Senator Cleland?
Let me just say, since you mentioned Senator Miller's name, I've known Senator Miller in many iterations as a senator, as a governor, as lieutenant governor. We've been friends for well over 30 years. We're colleagues in the Senate now, and it's a pleasure to work with him. I think we make a great team for Georgia. But Senator Miller and I are colleagues. We're not clones. We voted together about 80% of the time. We voted together on the president's $1.3 trillion tax cut. We voted together on the president's education reform initiative. We voted together in terms of supporting the president to go against the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But he's his own person, I'm my own person, and I think Georgia voters on November 5th are going to vote for the individual on the ballot, not who endorses them one way or the other, and I put my record out there for anybody to look at.
Cynthia Tucker.
This question is for Senator Cleland. You did vote for the president's tax cut, and the federal budget is now once again swimming in red ink, but you also support millions more in massive spending for a Medicare program for all seniors, including wealthy seniors who don't necessarily need the help, a prescription drug program. Where are we going to get the money from, and what programs would you cut to pay for this Medicare prescription drug program?
We're paying for everything now, quite frankly, out of the Social Security and Medicare Trust Fund. So if we're doing that, why don't we make sure there are at least some benefits there solidly in place for those on Social Security and on Medicare?
Here we go again. What he just said was, you don't cut Social Security and Medicare benefits to pay for a super expensive prescription drug program, but then you turn around and you spend the Social Security Trust Fund to pay for the Medicare prescription drug benefit. Now, that's wrong. And let me tell you, this is a fundamental difference in the fiscal policy and the fiscal philosophy between Mr. Cleland and myself. You know, on the House side, we acted very responsibly when it came to fiscal issues. We passed a budget this year. The Senate has not been able to pass a budget. When it came to a prescription drug benefit, on the House of Representatives, we passed a very responsible prescription drug benefit that was within our budget.
May I say that what Senator Miller and I in the Senate sponsored was legislation to provide a prescription drug benefit under Medicare that cares for seniors. What they passed in the House was a subsidy to insurance companies. If insurance companies could have taken care of this prescription drug benefit problem, it would have been solved long ago. We need a prescription drug benefit under Medicare for our seniors in this state.
But you didn't pass one, and you just said you're going to pay for it with Social Security Trust Fund money, Mr. Cleland, and that's wrong. You should take the money from the budget and pay for a prescription drug benefit like we did on the House side, and we could have it in the hands of seniors this year if y'all had passed one.
We could have our prescription drug benefit that Senator Miller and I support with 52 votes in the Senate, which we have, if we didn't have opposition across the aisle.
Excerpts from Sunday night's debate in Georgia's Senate race between incumbent Democrat Senator Max Cleland and his Republican challenger, Representative Saxby Chambliss. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're fine.